Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, Harvard University professor John Stauffer looks at African Americans and the Civil War. Professor Stauffer examines Abraham Lincoln's first inaugural address, focusing on the president's claim that secession was unconstitutional. Also discussed are the president's efforts to keep the border states in the Union, the Emancipation Proclamation, and the involvement of black soldiers in both the Union and Confederate armies. Harvard University is located in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is an hour and 40 minutes.
Today I want to begin the discussion with the most significant inaugural address in American history, which is Lincoln's inaugural, March 4th of 1861. I'll give you a bit of a background, and then I'd like your thoughts on it. I should say that Lincoln, in my view, is the nation's greatest literary president, and this inaugural address he labored over more than any other single document or piece of writing. When he gave it, seven states had already seceded, Confederacy had been formed, it was the most difficult difficult speech he actually gave. Here's a photograph of the U.S. Capitol. He gives it under the portico right here. His longtime nemesis, Stephen Douglas, was at his sides, held his hat, which was fallen off because it was so windy. This is how most Americans saw the inaugural address. This is from Harper's Weekly, which was the most popular magazine in the country. You can think of Harper's Weekly as the forerunner of Time Magazine or Life Magazine in the 20th century. And most Americans interpreted and understood Harper's as authentic representation of reality. Here's the portico here. The Capitol was unfinished, wonderfully symbolizing the kind of unfinished nature of the United States. Herman Melville, in his great collection of Civil War poetry, Battle Pieces and Aspects of War, wrote a poem, Conflict of Convictions, in which he describes the Iron Dome, the new Iron Dome, which would be put on. He says, "In the Iron Dome, stronger for stress and strain, fling her huge shadow athwart the main. But the founder's dream shall flee." For Melville and for many Northerners, and after the war certainly Southerners, the power of the federal government threatened to fling her shadow across the main streets of America and impose unprecedented dominion on communities and towns, destroying the founder's dream of a loose confederation of states and a decentralized government. So Lincoln, when he gives his address, was under such threat that he actually has to come into Washington, D.C. on the sly. His detective, Alan Pinkerton, thought that there was an attempt to assassinate Lincoln. In fact, many Southerners would make jokes about the desire to assassinate Lincoln. The day after his election, South Carolina announces its secession convention. Southerners had threatened, as you know, in previous weeks, for years to secede if their rights as slave owners were not respected. And Lincoln's election begins this swift chain of secession. Here's the first seven states who secede. Over a month before Lincoln even takes the oath of office, seven states had seceded. So his goal in giving the oath of, in giving the inaugural address, is based on the oath of office that he takes, which is to preserve the Union. Yeah.
I just have a question. Are these the dates? I know there are dates when these states would begin to kind of like draft their articles of secession, and then there's another date when it was actually ratified.
Yes.
Are these the dates when they were actually?
These are the dates they were ratified. So, South Carolina announces its secession convention the day after the election, so it's in November, and after they announce it, then they draft its the ordinance of secession, or the declaration, and actually the ordinance of secession is generally distinct from the Declaration of Secession, which I'll get to because Lincoln refers to it in the inaugural address. So these are the dates that actually the delegates of the state approve of secession, and so according to Southerners, it's legal. It's in every Southern state but Texas, secession was ultimately voted for by delegates rather than a popular election. Citizens voted for their delegates. The delegates went to the state and then voted for the state. So how do you interpret the inaugural address? You've probably read it before. Yeah.
Please use the microphone so we can hear you when you report.
It kind of seemed like there was almost like a feeling of desperation to it. Like,
okay,
he was trying to put on this whole like cool act, like, you know, we're not enemies, we're friends, we're buddies, you know. But at the same time, he is trying to make an argument, which is a very difficult argument to make, which is that the preservation of the Union is worth more than the sort of the liberty that the Southerners, so specifically like Jefferson Davis, when his argument, when he's speaking in Mississippi, he's saying that, you know, we're doing the same thing that the founders did.
That's,
you know, we're splitting off, and that, as you know, under the sort of Lockean social contract, we're splitting off, and that's our right, that's our duty, like we can do that. And he has to say, no, you can't, while at the same time, and he makes this argument based on sort of the need for a perpetual government, right? That the government needs to keep going for some reason. After reading, I still wasn't really sure exactly where the need for having a perpetual government comes from, but it seems like that's his answer to this very difficult question of saying, like, you know, you wanted to be in this, now you don't, but you can't leave. You know, I think that's a pretty challenging argument to make in this liberal framework.
Yes, that's a great, great point, because what at the time, the notion that secession was unconstitutional, that the Union was perpetual, was up for debate, up for wide debate, and not just among the secessionist Southerners. And so one of Lincoln's primary goals is to make the case that secession is unconstitutional, is illegal, and he elaborates on why he sees that.
I don't think that Lincoln came off as panicked in the address. Obviously, we don't get to see a video of it, but based on the text, I thought that he was very much concerned with not so much the states that had already left the Union, but the border states that might be considering leaving the Union.
Right.
And in that, I think he does a very good job of building an argument based on logic.
Right.
And I think that more than anything, it was about sending that message so that he could set like a precedence as a way of almost preparing himself for whatever was going to come next, given the other states that might succeed.
That's great. That's a very good point. I think that's it. I mean, one of his central concerns was that the border states do not follow these seven states who have already seceded, because if the border slave states secede, Washington, D.C. is surrounded. If both Maryland and Virginia secede, essentially the war's over. And Confederates have won. So a central goal for Lincoln throughout is to prevent these up the upper South, and especially the borders, the slave states or border the northern free states from seceding. What else? These are great points. Let me summarize his main aims. As you pointed out, his primary goal is to placate the Upper South. Not only Maryland and Virginia, but North Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, Arkansas, Missouri. Try to prevent them from seceding. Two, he wants to protect federal property in the South. Southerners, Confederates had already taken over many federal forts. There were two chief ones left. Three, Lincoln wanted to buy time and, in a sense, cool passions. And this notion of having the, using the inaugural address or his inaugural address to cool passions and buy time reflects a number of assumptions. One is Lincoln and many Northerners believed that the secessionists were essentially bluffing. From the Missouri crisis, Southerners had threatened to secede. They threatened to secede over the Missouri crisis. They threatened to secede during the controversy over the status of the new territories acquired from the Mexican War. They threatened to secede during the Compromise of 1850. They threatened to secede if the Kansas and Nebraska were not passed. That was their main source of really getting what they wanted, this threat to secede. So there was a long tradition of basically accommodating these Southern views. And third, the second is that the majority of Southerners, Lincoln himself, believed that the majority of Southerners opposed secession. That it was only a minority that actually voted for it. And as I mentioned, there's only one state, Texas, in which secession was by popular vote or referendum. And every other case it was by delegates. And one of, if not the most noted authority on the South and the eve of secession, William Freeling, in his relatively new book, The Road to Secession, or Road to Disunion, Volume 2, argues that if Southerners had voted for secession via referendum, they wouldn't have voted. That the majority of Southerners, remember, over two-thirds were non-slave-owning Southerners. And everyone understood the dire risks that one took by seceding. So Lincoln felt that if he could speak to the silent majority of Southerners, that would also persuade them to come back into the Union. And Lincoln also, in his inaugural, made it clear, according to his view, that there should be no compromise on the question of extending slavery. The central Republican platform on which Lincoln was voted, on which Lincoln was elected, was that slavery was an evil, prohibit the spread into federal territories, do not allow its extension into federal territories with the goal of ultimate extinction. And in the wake of the state seceding and the Confederacy was formed, Jefferson Davis took the oath of office on Washington's birthday. Many, if not most, Republicans were basically willing to give everything, to abandon their platform of non-extension. Lincoln said, no, if we give away the non-extension platform, we give away everything. So those were his chief aims. As you actually, in the brief responses, suggest one of my interpretations, and that is that Lincoln's inaugural was both progressive and conservative. Progressive because it explicitly and unambiguously tries to argue that secession was unconstitutional. Lincoln is very clear. The Union is perpetual. It's not you when you quoted it. Falls in no state upon its own mere motion can lawfully get out of the Union, that resolves an ordinance. Here he's referring to the ordinances of secession, the resolutions to secede, are legally void. Acts of violence with any state or states against the authority of the United States are insurrectionary or revolutionary. Secession is insurrectionary or revolutionary. Plainly, the central idea of secession is mere anarchy. Unconstitutional. And yet, for many Americans, secession was indeed considered constitutional. In fact, the preeminent legal authority at the time, Chief Justice Roger Taney, felt very strongly that secession was indeed legal and constitutional. In fact, to his friend Franklin Pierce, the former president, he hopes that this secession can result in a peaceful disunion, a peaceful separation, free institutions in each section. This is the preeminent legal authority in the country, in the land. Now, this was a private letter, so it doesn't carry the weight of the Chief Justice's public legal opinion, but he made it very clear that he believed secession was legal. Those arguing that secession was constitutional, not only Chief Roger Taney, but the former president, Franklin Pierce, former president, James Buchanan, and actually three of the four men who had created the timbers of the house that Lincoln describes in his House Divided. Stephen Douglas believed secession was unconstitutional. Many Northern Democrats, when Nathaniel Hawthorne was one, Nathaniel Hawthorne said, you know, let the South go. Just amputate them, let them go. And many, if not most, Southern Democrats believe secession was constitutional. There's a long tradition on the constitutionality of disunion. Until the nullification crisis, 1832-33, when South Carolina threatens to nullify the federal law, essentially the tariff law, which penalized cotton producers because it makes their prices more expensive, and it helps Northern industrialists so that they can compete better with foreign countries. And Jackson, President Jackson, intervened and threatened to send in federal troops to South Carolina. Essentially, the tariff was reduced, and there was no violence. But until this nullification crisis, most statesmen had maintained that the states were sovereign and that the Union was a compact, a revocable compact, a kind of treaty or league, yeah.
I was just wondering, in Lincoln's address, he makes some homages to Jackson's message of union,
yes.
Not explicitly,
yes.
But sort of implicitly. Would that have been familiar to his audience?
Yes, that's a great... So, it would have been familiar, because what Jackson does during the nullification crisis... Now, Jackson is himself a slave-owning Southerner, but he is outraged that South Carolina and John C. Calhoun are going against him, and Jackson loved nothing more than a fight. So after South Carolina threatens to nullify federal law, Jackson publicly vows to send in federal troops unless they renounce it, unless they repudiate it, and he privately sends a notice to John C. Calhoun and other South Carolina leaders and said, if you don't renounce this nullification, I'm personally going to enjoy watching you hang. I mean, he was a strong president. Yeah.
Microphone.
Do we have more microphones, by the way? No.
First, I'd just like to point out that South Carolina nullified the force bill after, so.
That's true.
Yeah. The nullification crisis, like verbiage, is based off of the Kentucky and Virginia resolution. So it's not just coming out of nowhere.
That's true. Right, there so. Was a, that's a very good point. Right. That's a very good point. That's a very good point. Thank you. So this notion that the union is a revocable compact, a kind of treaty or league, is acknowledged by two of the nation's great Federalists, Justice Joseph Story, one of the founders of Harvard Law School. And he notes or says that if the Constitution is a compact between the states, it operates as a mere treaty or convention between them and has an obligatory force no longer than suits its pleasure. If it's a compact, then disunion is acceptable. Now, Story did not believe that it was acceptable because he's saying this in the wake of the nullification. So in essence, the Federalists, after the nullification crisis, people like Daniel Webster, Story, they say, no, the Constitution is not a compact, does not represent a compact between the states. Here's Daniel Webster. If a league between sovereign powers containing, between the sovereign powers containing nothing, making it perpetual, it subsists only during the good pleasure of both parties. So if the Constitution is a compact between the states, secession is constitutional. And Lincoln clearly was arguing that it's not a compact. He's also wanting to argue against a common Southern perspective, as reflected by Jefferson Davis, who makes a very logical point that one of you pointed out. And the colonies had the right to secede from the British. And if the colonies, if we as a nation had the right to leave Britain, why isn't it the right of a sovereign state to secede from the federal government? It's a very logical assumption. And it's no coincidence that Davis gives his inaugural address on Washington's birthday, specifically referring to this, the birthday of the man most identified with the establishment of American independence, an establishment that results out of an act of disunion. And so secession, like the slavery debates which we discussed last week, itself reflects this constitutional crisis. Point out that Dred Scott creates this constitutional crisis. Secession itself reflects the constitutional crisis. Lincoln said at the end of the Cooper Union Address, in which, remember last week, it's the best way to understand it, it's a legal brief against the Supreme Court's decision in Dred Scott. He said that Chief Justice Taney's opinion is wrong. And he says, let us have faith that right makes might. In essence, secession became unconstitutional because might made right. After the Civil War, it became clear that secession or disunion was wrong. And in fact, that becomes a Supreme Court ruling in Texas v. White in 1868, which explicitly declares secession to be unconstitutional. So Lincoln's inaugural address is profoundly progressive, in which he establishes, far more than any document had, the notion that secession is wrong, that at the time was widely debated. And now, when, you know, Texas governor recently, you know, suggested secession, he was mostly just laughed at. That goes back to the influence of this first inaugural. It's also conservative. Why is it? Well, I say, forces the Fugitive Slave Act, suppresses slave insurrections, and protects slavery in the states. He's explicitly, here's from Lincoln's inaugural, I have no purpose directly or indirectly to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. Now, the abolitionists reading that, it's like they respond by saying, well, what about your platform of gradual abolition with the goal of ultimate extinction? I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and that was true. Republicans did not believe that they could constitutionally intervene in the slave states where slavery existed. And he makes it very clear that he will support the Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution to send back suspected fugitives. He also says something that especially outrages Frederick Douglass and other abolitionists. This is from his inaugural address. I understand a proposed amendment to the Constitution, which amendment, however, I have not seen has passed Congress, to the effect that the federal government shall never interfere with the domestic institutions of the states, including that of persons held to service. I have no objection to its being made express and irrevocable. Anyone know what he's referring to? Yeah.
He's saying that he wouldn't interfere with the states' rights to, like, say whether or not they would, like, slavery would be legal. But
yes.
But you know, at one point he says he would preserve the Union, whether that meant freeing all the slaves, or freeing some of them.
Yeah, that comes in August of 62 later.
So did he have this opinion now, or was he just saying this to kind of appease the border states?
That's, I mean, he's clearly wanting to appease the Upper South. and appease the South more generally. He's clearly, you know, that's why he vows not to interfere with slavery in the slave states. But he goes further than to say, you know, I believe I don't have a constitutional right to interfere with slavery in the slave states. He goes further than to say that I'll make sure that fugitives are returned to their property, to the property owners. What he's referring to is that 2 days before he gives this inaugural address, Congress, in its efforts to conciliate with the South, passes a new constitutional amendment. It's the first 13th Amendment. Now, you all know the 13th Amendment is the amendment that abolishes slavery. The first 13th Amendment is, the language is really weird because it essentially is an unamendable amendment. It says, no amendment shall be made to the Constitution which will authorize or give to Congress the power to abolish or interfere within any state with the domestic institutions thereof, including that of persons held to labor service by the laws of said state. It's an amendment that guarantees slavery in the slave states forever. And Lincoln supports it. Yeah.
Was this amendment something that the general public would have known about, or would it be?
Yes, it was, the general public knew about it. It had just been passed. So in the age of telegraph, 2 days later, people living in cities would have known about it. And it was just beginning to spread. It was obviously never ratified. But it wasn't everywhere known, which is why Lincoln elaborates a bit. And he acknowledges he hasn't even read it.
I just feel like he was very cryptic about it. And I think that Lincoln has the capacity to be very explicit and very eloquent. And I just don't understand why he wasn't more explicit when he was talking about the first 13th Amendment.
Because he actually says, I haven't seen it. He hasn't read it. It's just been passed. He knows it's been debated. He hasn't even read the thing. But he says, I have no objection. I support it. I have supported in principle.
So why doesn't he sign it, then, if it's passed?
It hasn't been ratified.
It hasn't been ratified.
Right. And it never would be, yeah.
Can we use the microphone, please? Because we can't hear your voices when we're recording.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess what I was kind of wondering about is the political pressure that would have been put on Lincoln by the abolitionists. Because it seems like kind of he's playing to, you know, kind of quite literally the middle of America, you know, especially in supporting this. Whereas, you know, I mean, right after he makes the inaugural address, you know, Frederick Douglass comes out and says, you know, writes that essay where he's, you know, calls him like a slave catcher, basically.
Yes, yes.
So I guess I was wondering is, you know, if Lincoln ends up, you know, by the end of the war, you know, writing the Emancipation Proclamation, kind of what is it that makes him, I don't know, what kind of causes that political
that's
shift?
We're going to get to a little bit of that today. To what degree do the abolitionists influence Lincoln? I think a lot. I think Douglass, I mean, we know that Lincoln knew of Douglass when they first met. Douglass was the first black man to meet with the U.S. president in terms of near equality, and first black man to really advise the president on substantive issues. He met Lincoln 3 times. Lincoln recognized him immediately because we now know that Frederick Douglass was the most photographed American in the United States. More photographs of separate poses of Douglass than Lincoln, than anyone else. For most of his career, as I mentioned last week, until 1860, Douglass was better known. And Lincoln is very familiar with Douglass's criticism. And so he was sensitive to the abolitionist response. He was also very close with Charles Sumner, who was the most abolitionist senator who met with Lincoln more than just about any other congressman at the time. There are scholars who say that, you know, Lincoln stage-managed events, which Lincoln himself contradicts. He says events controlled me. Essentially, I mean, this is giving a bit away next week especially, but Lincoln came to the conclusion that the Union War, his chief aim to preserve the Union, ultimately meant that he had to abolish slavery. That the abolitionist discrete aim of a war to end slavery really converged with Lincoln's chief aim, which was a war to preserve the Union, because you can't have one without the other. In order to preserve the Union, you have to end slavery. In order to end slavery, you have to preserve the Union, because you need blacks on your side to preserve the Union. We'll elaborate on that today and especially next week. But Douglass made that very clear. Was there another question? Now, to go back to Lincoln's inaugural address, now what you might not know is that Lincoln actually had drafted it, that he labored over, and when he arrives in Washington, he circulates the draft to some advisors. And in the draft that he circulates, he opposes congressional efforts to amend the Constitution. His draft, he says, I'm for the old ship. He opposes, in his draft, he knew that Congress was debating this new 13th Amendment. They hadn't passed it. He vows to reclaim the federal forts that had been captured rather than simply preserve those that were remaining in federal hands. And in his draft, it's a much firmer ending. His draft, he ends by saying, with you and not with me is the solemn question of shall it be peace or the sword. Your choice. He circulates this draft to William Seward in particular, who thinks it's way too strong, plus some other Republican advisors, Orville Browning, Francis Blair. And based on their recommendations, he changes it. Now he supports the 13th Amendment. Now he vows to only protect federal forts under your control. And now he has this memorable, truly brilliant, softer ending. Mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Now that the language actually comes primarily from William Seward, who suggests this for the ending, the mystic chords, which now Seward didn't have the ear, the musical ear that Lincoln did. So he suggests the mystic chords, but in a very clunky phrase, Lincoln appropriates them and as a literary person develops it into that last stanza. So the Southern response to his inaugural, Southerners interpreted it as a declaration of war. Here's one quote from a South Carolina editor. It racializes Lincoln, saying that he's an orangutan, sounded the tocsin of battle, which is the signal of our freedom. A Virginia editor says it inaugurates civil war. Many Southerners characterized Lincoln's vice president, Hannibal Hamlin, as a mulatto. And so some of them, when they joke, well, we'd like to assassinate Lincoln, but if we do, that means a mulatto's president. We don't want that. But they hated it. They hated it because he called slavery evil. And remember that Southerners, the very idea that one calls slavery evil is a threat to Southern honor. It's also, Southerners understand that the laws depend on morality to a certain degree. Higher law proliferates because Northerners believe in slavery's evil. So when Lincoln, brilliantly summarizes the central debate of the war, one side believes slavery is right and ought to be extended, the other side believes it's wrong, it's evil, ought to be contained. No one disagreed with what he said. They were just outraged that he would call slavery evil. They're also outraged that Lincoln says secession is treason. It's insurrection, a revolution, it's anarchy. And from a Southern perspective, he's thumbing his nose at the Supreme Court, particularly the Dred Scott decision. Lincoln says in his inaugural address, he says, the candid citizen must confess that if the policy of the government upon vital questions is to be irrevocably fixed by the decisions of the Supreme Court, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers, having resigned their government into the hands of that eminent tribunal. And yet, Southerners understood the Supreme Court and most Americans at one level to be the highest tribunal in the land. And in a sense, this passage is denying the validity of judicial review, the idea that the Supreme Court can overturn acts of legislature. How did, the Southerners, this is, summarizes the Confederate view of secession. This is from Vice President Alexander Stephens. "Our new government rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth." To contradict this acceptance, this notion, is inflammatory. What's the Northern response? Most Republicans and Democrats liked it. It's profoundly subtle. In a sense, it has something for everyone. I think it's actually, in many respects, a brilliant document. It's both progressive and conservative, as I've suggested. Although abolitionists hated it because of Lincoln's conciliatory posture to the secessionists, to slave-owning Southerners. In fact, Frederick Douglass, here's what he says. It's a little better than our worst fears. You read some of his response. He refers to Lincoln as double-tongued because he's elected on a platform to confine slavery where it is, where the public mind shall rest in the belief of its ultimate extinction. And in his essay, Frederick Douglass is quoting Lincoln. And yet he is endorsing a constitutional amendment that guarantees slavery in the slave states forever. For Douglass and other abolitionists, it's courting the favor of rebels. Douglass certainly agrees that that Confederates are rebels. That's the term that was used. In fact, Lincoln never dignifies the Confederates by even referring to them as such. He always calls them rebels. The closest he'll come is by saying throughout the war is so-called Confederacy, so-called Confederates. Because to use the term Confederates or Confederacy legitimates the very secession and the new government. And Douglass is saying, you're courting the favor of these rebels. In fact, the closest Frederick Douglass ever comes to abandoning his faith in national ideals, articulating the Declaration, is immediately after reading Lincoln's inaugural address. He plans a trip to Haiti. And he plans to trip to Haiti to see if, in fact, it is the Black Republic he's read about. And if it is, he's going to move there and settle there permanently and encourage other blacks to do the same. Because with Abraham Lincoln as president, there's no way this nation can ever come close to achieving national ideals. Now, he doesn't go to Haiti, doesn't go on his trip. Anyone know why? Fort Sumter. Are captured in Harper's Weekly, and this is from the perspective of Confederates. I think, so Lincoln, right after he gives his inaugural address, goes to the White House. Like, the first item of business is this memo from Major Robert Anderson, who's the commander of Fort Sumter, with a dispatch saying that supplies at Fort Sumter are going to last only another week or two. My men are going to starve to death. They're going to have to surrender unless you send us supplies. So Lincoln is faced with this profound choice. Fort Sumter is in the heart of the Confederacy, in South, just off of Charleston, South Carolina. So in a sense, he has three options. He can try to shoot his way in, send gunboats and arms. But if he does that, he's going to be accused of starting the war. He's going to outrage Southerners. He could just give up Fort Sumter and say, okay, take it. We don't need it. Take it. If he does that, he's going to divide the North. Northern is going to be outraged that he's not defending federal property. Or he can do what he did, which is to send a boat with provisions only, no guns, no arms, notify the South Carolina governor in advance. Hey, just to let you know, we're sending food because our men are starving. This is not an act of belligerence. They're starving to death. They're in this federal fort. And that way, if South Carolinians do anything, then the onus is on them for starting the war. It's a brilliant ploy. And South Carolinians refuse to allow this, this aid of food to reach Fort Sumner. And on April 12th at 4:30 a.m., they begin bombing Fort Sumter for 33 hours until the surrender. Here's a perspective from the fort itself by a Harper's Weekly and Frank Leslie's. They had sketch artists, which are the precursors of photojournalists, on site. And they would draw the sketch, send it to the headquarters. They would engraver would cut an engraving from the sketch. What are the effects of Fort Sumter bombing? Lincoln calls for 75,000 troops for 90 days. Northerners and Southerners both thought that the war would last no more than 3 months. Both sides thought the war would end very quickly. Southerners felt, because of their long tradition of martial ideals of fighting, which was one of the most popular forms of entertainment in the South, duels were still common in the South. Southerners felt that it would take 10 Northerners to defeat one Southerner. And Northerners felt that because of their manpower, their industrial base, they would just destroy the South in 3 months. Very few people thought the war would last more than 6 months. And Lincoln, desire for revenge and the unity among most Northerners was such that Lincoln could have easily raised 400,000 troops. He, in fact, they had to turn many away. It unites Northern whites really as never before. Frederick Douglass acknowledges it. Government is aroused. Dead North is alive. Abolitionists, one of the fascinating aspects of abolitionism or of the abolitionists is that when Lincoln gives his inaugural, the self-described abolitionists are still a minority, tiny minority, and they're still despised. What transforms abolitionists into respected, prescient critics of the American scene is Fort Sumter. They're suddenly respected as never before. Now more people attend abolitionist meetings than ever before, because essentially the war proves the abolitionists right. And the greatest reason for why abolitionists were excoriated is now no longer on the table. That is that they threatened to divide the country. They threatened to incite disunion. The Fort Sumter, because of Lincoln's calling for 75,000 troops, also leads directly to the Second Secession in between April and early May. And in fact, Lincoln suspends habeas corpus and imprisons some Maryland politicians in the attempt to prevent Maryland from seceding. So from the outset, the reason why Douglass stays and doesn't go to Haiti is he understands, as do other abolitionists, that this military war is a golden opportunity to end slavery. And from the beginning, from Fort Sumter, Frederick Douglass is really emblematic. He's by this point, if not the most respected, one of the most respected abolitionists, and probably the most famous because of his brilliance as an orator and a writer. Here's his how to end the war. You end slavery immediately. You arm blacks. 10,000 black soldiers could be raised in the next 30 days. They would be thrilled to fight. In fact, he says, by preventing whites from being soldiers, which Lincoln's call for 75,000 troops does, he says, you're only fighting with your white hand. By ending slavery, arming blacks, you can tap into this vital black power and quickly and easily vanquish the Confederacy. Yeah.
So one thing that I noticed, especially in kind of the Douglass reading from this week and how it contrasted with the other Douglass reading that we did, is that it seems he's taking on kind of much more of a national identity.
Yes, very much.
Does that happen only after secession?
Yeah, that's a great... So Douglass becomes kind of national spokesperson for the abolitionists and for the North, really, during the Civil War. He's already a household name on the eve of the Civil War, but the Civil War makes Douglass far more famous than even he had been before. In fact, in the wake of the war, after the war, he becomes an elder statesman. He becomes a Republican insider. And he is very closely involved. He, through every newspaper, he devotes the entire paper to coverage of the war and his views and other views, and takes on those of Lincoln and other Republicans. He gives his speeches now are to more people than ever before. I think that's a great way to summarize it. He's a kind of national mouthpiece. I think it's a great way to summarize it. He calls for repealing the Fugitive Slave Law, which made sense. I mean, after all, the Confederacy, they're insurgents, they're rebels. Why should we dignify Fugitive Slave Law to this, to belligerents, to insurrectionaries? And by repealing the Fugitive Slave Law, ending slavery, arming blacks, the 4 million slaves will know exactly who their friends are and who their enemies. And after all, blacks constitute a third of the South in terms of population. They know the landscape, they know the rivers, they can be indispensable sources of aid. And the fifth reason is that if you right up front make this an abolition war, it means that England in particular, there's no way it can recognize us, the Confederacy. Because England is leading the Western world in seeking to perpetuate this wave of emancipation. And although England is losing money, because immediately after the war, the Union creates a blockade around the South, preventing Southerners from sending their cotton to England to be turned into finished goods and cloth. So the textile workers and owners in England are suffering profoundly. But if the war is an abolition war, England is not going to recognize the Confederacy. And until then, it's up for grabs, which we'll see. Other thoughts on Douglass's response to Lincoln and Douglass's view of the war? You had a number of pieces from Douglass. Yeah.
I'm just interested in England's motivation in not recognizing the Confederacy, because if the Union is preventing England from getting goods that it needs,
right,
it seems that England would see more of an enemy in the Union than it would in the Confederacy.
That's a great question. I mean, and you're right. From an economic standpoint, the Union is more of an enemy than it is a friend to England. But England, when it emancipated slavery in the British West Indies, and the emancipation more generally, is when people made a decision that went against their pocketbook. When England agreed, when England passed its Emancipation Act, they knew it was costing them immense amounts of money. That they specifically made a decision in which their moral vision outstripped their economic desire. And they were proud of that. They were proud of that. They also felt that by convincing everyone else to also emancipate slavery, there would be a level playing field economically. But they were proud of that. And by, as I mentioned before, by 1860, most of the New World had abolished slavery. And slavery, it was the West's first big business. So England was very sensitive to the fact that their moral claims and their desire to realize them will trump economic incentives. Now, that was debated. England ultimately comes very close to recognizing the Confederacy. According to James McPherson, had Lincoln not issued his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation when he did right after Antietam, within 2 weeks or so, England was close to recognizing the Confederacy. And had England officially recognized the Confederacy, essentially that would have meant a Confederate victory. Because now England could break the blockade. More importantly, now the Confederacy could receive guns, ships, armaments from the powerhouse of England. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, aside from the moral reasons for England not being involved in the war, like on a practical level, it, like the opportunity never came up where it made sense because the Union Navy was much stronger than, like, it's not as if the Confederacy had a Navy that was equal to the Confederacy, to the Navy of the Union. And so it would have just been the British Navy against the Union Navy, which, to be fair, the British Navy was strong,
right,
but they're in enemy territory.
Right.
Moreover, it's kind of like in the American Revolution where French involvement didn't come until there was a turning point in the war where the colonists had already demonstrated enough victories to kind of be like a sure thing. And I feel like the Confederacy never got it together. It was always kind of a tug and war between the Union and the Confederacy.
Right. I think that's a very good point, although there's a relatively new book by Stan Ingerman who argues that the Union blockade was not that effective. And so had England recognized the Confederacy, it would have just blown apart that blockade, and the cotton could have easily been shipped to England. Yeah.
I think what Douglas recognizes is that the Union actually needed the ideal of fighting for slavery to become more efficient in its war practices.
That's right. That's very good.
And up until that point, up until ending the fugitive slave law, up until emancipation, there was always the question of compromise.
Yes.
And I think Douglas declares how this creates inefficiency, weak-heartedness.
Yes.
There's always the lingering question of, well, if the South will compromise, we will give up certain elements. And Douglas saw what many Northerners weren't willing to accept, which is that the South viewed the North as enemies, while the North had not yet given up the South as sort of brotherly states.
That's right.
With the addition of, like, the slavery ideal, we are fighting to end slavery, the war can't end if the South compromises. The South has to give in. And
right.
I think that put the war into entirely new terms.
Yes.
And the only way that the war was going to end in the North's favor was if they fought wholeheartedly against an enemy and not just for reuniting with compromise.
That's a great point. Those are great points. Douglas recognized what many people didn't until near the end of the war, and that is to win the war and to preserve the Union, you had to completely vanquish the South. And it had to lead to an unconditional surrender. Because Southerners, all they have to do is hang on. They can suffer as many military defeats as you want, but as long as they remain a Confederacy, as long as they don't surrender unconditionally, no matter how destroyed their territory is, they can remain a separate nation. And slavery was the centerpiece of that nation. Yeah.
We see this like England.
We see this whole this England bit and the importance of England and of making that moral point about ending slavery with the John Stuart Mill.
Yes,
when he talks about the contest in America, he basically argues, you know, he's a liberal. He supports people's rights. You know, sometimes like insurrection, revolution can be okay, but he makes a distinction where he says on 142, he says, secession may be laudable, and so may any other kind of insurrection, but it may also be an enormous crime. It is the one or the other according to the object and the provocation. And basically then argues that the rebels, the Confederates, they're basically, though they're trying to fight for their independence, they're enemies of mankind. On the page before, he says, you know, they're not in rebellion for simple slavery. They're in rebellion for the right of burning human creatures alive.
Right.
And argues that there is this moral distinction, like there's some people who are good for fighting back and some people who are not. In this case, like, these people are just straight up evil.
That's very good.
And we can't support them.
That's a great point. That's a very good point. In fact, let's jump to the England's dilemma. The people who suffered the most in England were the working class textile, the mill workers. They were literally starving to death. I mean, even before the Civil War, you can't really call them free in the way most political theorists define freedom, and that individual freedom is the freedom of mobility. The mill workers didn't have a choice of getting a job elsewhere. They were truly exploited. And with the blockade and with the secession of cotton being imported, textiles, the factories either shut down or they had work stoppages. And it reached a point by mid-1862 in which throughout England there are massive drives for food, for money that will prevent the deaths, literally the deaths of the mill workers. This is from the front page of the Illustrated London News. It's somehow blurry. The time has gone by for any nice measurement of the extent to which destitution prevails in the cotton district. That was no exaggeration, absolute destitution. Here's another full page from Illustrated London News showing a soup and food drive. The thousands of people who are making food just to prevent these mill workers from starving to death. Now, mill, in a sense, represents John Stuart Mill represents the mill workers' voice. The cotton spinners in England were among, in many respects, the heroes of the Civil War. Because although they were being exploited, they refused to encourage England to recognize the Confederacy. Why? Because although they were exploited working class mill workers, they understood that slavery, they believed that slavery threatened their own dignity and identity as free laborers. That they were proud of being free laborers even though they weren't making that much. That slavery threatened that. And they were the staunchest supporters of the Union. Of the opportunity to end slavery. And Mill, in his essay, in a sense, is voicing that view. Workers are starving to death because of the Union blockade. And Mill spoke for them. Workers refused to recognize the Confederacy, break the Union blockade. And they truly should be seen as among the great heroes of the war collectively. Karl Marx, who wrote a column for Horace Greeley's New York Tribune in the 1850s and followed the war passionately because he saw the war as a step in his vision of communism and believed that the war reflected the unity of the working classes internationally. And here he essentially says as much. He says the misery that the stoppage of the factories and the shortening of the labor time motivated by the blockade of the slave states has produced among the workers in the northern manufacturing districts is incredible. So on the one hand, they're facing total misery. Working class is conscious that the government is only waiting for their cry from the pressure without. Now, Marx is off base, in my view, in thinking that social change always occurs from the margins, that if the working classes just actually come together, that's going to produce a revolution. Historically, it's a dialectic between what goes on in the margins and what goes on in the seats of power. But he's right in noting that they're refusing to call for, the working classes in England are refusing to call for recognition of the Confederacy. And, in fact, they're supporting the United States. This new is a brilliant proof of the indestructible excellence of the English popular classes. Mill and Marx understood what was going on. Yeah. Microphone.
I was just going to say that it seems like the working class in England recognized maybe deeper motives that haven't been that much discussed in Southern government, which is that as much as they discuss states' rights and democracy, there were elements of an oligarchy about the type of government they set up. And it's interesting that Marx actually described the Civil War as partially a social war and a struggle between class systems. Yes. And I think you see that when Jefferson Davis talks about how hierarchies of white race in the North and racializes Germans and Irish. Yes. I think you see that there was almost a battle for equality that was going on, not just for black and white, but also for workers in general.
Yes.
Within the war.
Right. I think that's a great point. There's an important exception, and that is when Lincoln issues conscription. If you're wealthy, you could get out of conscription. You could pay a substitute. But it wasn't nearly the degree to which it was in the Confederacy. After all, the Confederacy is unambiguous about saying we are forming this new nation to protect and to propagate slavery. So this new nation, only a third, less than a third of the population is even slave owners. It'd be like saying, it would be like the 1% of the nation today forming a new nation and assuming that everyone else is on board. Now, it is true that, you know, very few poor people today oppose the system of capitalism because they figure, you know, hey, I might be poor now, but in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, I can get rich. Much the same way the non-slave owners most non-slave-owning Southerners didn't oppose the institution of slavery because, as I've mentioned, the easiest way to get rich is you buy a slave and you go southwest. But Jefferson Davis and the Confederate leaders were much more explicit about acknowledging this natural hierarchy. It's reflected in George Fitzhugh's. The pro-slavery ideal reflects a natural hierarchy, and one should respect it. One should know one's place. It's a superb point. And you're absolutely right that the Marx understands that this is what the British working class are arguing for, are fighting against. In essence, it's an acknowledgement that race and class are profoundly intertwined. One of the central differences is that while the British working classes were the most vigorous champions of abolitionism, the northern working classes in the United States as a group were the most racist because they had to compete with blacks for jobs. England had it easier. There were very few blacks in England at the time, particularly compared to the United States. So it meant that there was less reason for the working classes to feel threatened by the presence of blacks. Yeah, Dan, there's a microphone.
One of the things that struck me about going back to the Marx, the London workers' meeting, he talks about how the silence is admirable.
Yes.
And it struck me that that's actually, in a way, what Lincoln is doing in his first inaugural.
That's
also.
Exactly right.
He's
great point.
He's staking out a position of inaction,
yes.
Of silence.
Yes.
And sort of, and that's in a way, after Sumter, Douglas also is able to then be part of the status quo as opposed to fighting against the status quo.
That's a very good
point.
And that
position is a position of power. When silence equals a defense of the status quo, that suddenly silence becomes a position of power as opposed and puts the Southerners, the Confederacy, in the mode of the actors who have to defend their actions as opposed to those who remain silent who don't have to defend their silence.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. Can we bring the mic down here?
I definitely agree with that point, especially since the South is sort of characterized traditionally as the hot-headed people.
Right.
And I think Marx kind of, sorry.
But that was a stereotype. That
and I think Marx kind of addresses that in his other article, The Civil War in the United States, when he talks about how the Confederacy wasn't a country at all, but a battle slogan.
Yes.
And I think that was a really cool point. And when I read that, I kind of was like, oh, yes, you know, because it was kind of just a lot of the actions just seemed very much about the actions themselves rather than the motivations behind them.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. The Confederacy from the beginning, the act of secession, it was much more action than the theories in the development except for slavery kind of followed suit. I mean, they cobbled together a constitution, you know, in a matter of weeks, and they mostly copied the U.S. Constitution except they guarantee slavery in it and in perpetuity, and they explicitly make clear that that any new territory is slavery is legal. So let's move on, because we still have a fair amount to cover. Here's Lincoln's policy on the war. So you've mentioned preserve the Union. That's his chief aim. It's always his chief aim. Prevent border states from seceding. That is crucial for reasons that I mentioned. Also, Kentucky has enormous resources. It's a huge state. And Frederick Douglass, you know, says that the border states are a millstone around Lincoln's neck. He's, in his view, Douglass responds to the worry about the border states in essence by saying, well, Lincoln has already shown that his administration is very efficient at suspending habeas corpus, at silencing and imprisoning Northern Copperhead Democrats. And just do that more vigorously, more aggressively. William Seward at one point during the war said that he could have any Northerner imprisoned in 24 hours. Douglas said, go for it. Then the border states aren't a problem. You know, if a border state politician starts threatening to secede, just throw them in prison. It's, after all, civil war. Prevent social revolution. Lincoln was, especially compared to abolitionists and many other Republicans even, he is not a revolutionary. He wants to preserve the Union without a social revolution, and he knows ending slavery is a social revolution. That's why he comes late to turning the war to end the Union also into war to end slavery. Throughout, really, even into 1863, after the Emancipation Proclamation, his policy towards the border states, the loyal slave states, is still gradual emancipation, compensate masters for the loss of their property, and colonization. Until mid-1863, Lincoln is still endorsing colonization. That had been his policy. As I've mentioned, it's a very gradual solution to slavery. It follows the vision of the founders. That had been his policy from his first articulation of his hatred of slavery. And so this is an oversimplification, but in a sense you could say that Lincoln's policy on the war and much of his administration is that it assumed the U.S. was and would remain a white man's democracy, after all, to turning it into a democracy in which blacks are equal under the law. That's a social revolution. That is a social revolution. So Lincoln, from the outset, wants to sideline initially blacks within the United States. And yet from the beginning of the war, whether it's Frederick Douglass's voice, whether it's Harper's Weekly, the most popular magazine, here is Harper's Weekly illustrating Lincoln's inaugural. What's front and center of the front page? A black man. He's a black driver who's actually driving Lincoln to the inaugural address. When Lincoln calls for troops, he explicitly prohibits blacks from fighting. And yet, many blacks fight as independent soldiers. They're not legal, but they want nothing more than to be able to shoot and kill their old slave owners, and slave owners more generally. And Harper's Weekly, in illustrating from an eyewitness sketch artist the Battle of Bull Run, the first major battle of the war, front and center of Harper's Weekly's illustration are two black Union soldiers, right here and right here. It's not legal, but Harper's Weekly and the Americans understand that you cannot sideline African Americans. They're part of this war, and they're fighting from the beginning. And here's a engraving based on a drawing by Winslow Homer, who got a start working as a sketch artist for Harper's Weekly. Homer did the sketch of inaugural. It's a camp scene. Now, this is an African-American black man dancing. It has racist connotations now, kind of blackface minstrel, jump Jim Crow dance. And yet, it's rendered very seriously by Homer. We don't see his face. And more importantly, He is at the center of this social life. The centerpiece of the war is the black man. It's African Americans. You can't exclude them. You can't simply try to preserve the Union, pretend that blacks are not around. From the beginning, blacks are accepted as sailors on integrated ships. Why are they accepted as sailors and not as soldiers? Or one, the Navy is outside of the public gaze. It's not considered that significant. It's one thing for blacks to serve as sailors on integrated ships. It's another thing to put guns in the hands of black soldiers, which are in the front of public view, and tell them to go shoot whites. Secondly, blacks as sailors have a long tradition in American history of essentially being masters of the waterways. They understood the rivers, the ocean. They were more comfortable with ships than most whites. The most integrated communities in the United States from the Revolution to the Civil War were on board ship. And everyone understood that. And further, if you want to try to segregate the ship, that's lunacy. It's too small. When blacks are eventually allowed to serve as soldiers in the Northern Army, they're still segregated, but that's much easier because it's on land. So from the beginning, sailors are on integrated ships. Blacks from the beginning fight as independent soldiers. And there are a number of examples. One, Nicholas Biddle, he's in a sense one of the first casualties of the Civil War. He's a black man who joins the Washington Artillerists as an independent on his way to defend the Capitol. This white mob in Maryland attacks the regiment, they injure him, and he is aided and taken to safety by his fellow white officer. And then William Johnson, the black correspondent for the Pine and Palm, who fights as an independent soldier in the first Battle Bull Run, or Manassas, which you read. Now, how many of you remember what Johnson says? Here's part of it. He's describing the Confederacy's victory at First Manassas. And he says it was, among other things, I was not alone the white man's victory, for it was won by slaves. Yes, the Confederates had three regiments of blacks in the field, and they maneuvered like veterans and beat the Union men back. This is not guessing, but it's a fact. It has angered our men, and they say there must be retaliation. There's much talk in high places and by leading men of a call being made for the blacks of the North to enter the army against the Southern slaves and by opposing, free them. Now, in the edition in which this letter occurs, the editor says there's no objective evidence that blacks fought for the Confederacy. It is the most controversial topic of the Civil War. Let me just briefly summarize the controversy, and then I'm interested in your thoughts on William Johnson. The controversy occurs really... it doesn't begin until the 1970s when scholars first start to argue, white scholars first start to acknowledge that the Civil War was first and foremost about slavery. And once scholars begin in the 20th century to acknowledge that slavery is the central cause of the Civil War, which implicates the Confederacy in ways that are not exactly moral, what I would call neo-Confederates point to a number of eyewitness accounts like William Johnson and describe tens, hundreds of thousands of blacks who loyally supported the Confederacy or even fought for them. What does that do? It purges the Confederacy from the moral association of slavery. I mean, after all, if hundreds of thousands, even a million blacks fought for the Confederacy or supported them, well, how could it be immoral from our anti-racist perspective today? When I say anti-racist, meaning it's socially unacceptable to be racist. Doesn't mean there aren't races. And in response to the rise of neo-Confederate writings describing all of the support among African Americans, free blacks and slaves for the Confederacy, essentially it's reached a point now where virtually no liberal white historian will acknowledge that even one black could have fought for the Confederacy. that any assumptions that they did are just wrong. And they're not interrogating the sources, clearly. So, you read an account by this African-American, and I should say, at the time, the voices, the eyewitness voices, the people who identify the blacks may have fought for the Confederacy, were mostly African-Americans. And one of the reasons why William Johnson is identifying the fact that the Confederate victory was a black victory, that blacks helped the Confederates win, is it's his way of spurring the Union to say, hey, Confederacy is making use of blacks. Why don't we? We lost this battle. For the first year of the war, the Union is desperate for a victory. Now, the Confederacy legally allowed slaves to be used as laborers to build roads, forts, trenches, fortifications. But it's only the last week of the war, beginning March of 65, where the Confederacy legally allowed slaves to serve as soldiers as a last-ditch attempt to help preserve the Confederacy, and virtually no blacks did at that point. What do you make of Johnson's account? You also read in your packet an essay by Frederick Douglass, who also describes black Confederates. I should say that my interest in black Confederacy emerged out of Frederick Douglass. I've given one talk on it, and I felt like wearing a bullseye because it's so combustible. Especially if seriously, I don't know. I mean, there are very few liberal whites who will acknowledge that any black fought for the Confederacy. Here's Douglass. It's now pretty well established that there are, at the present moment, many colored men in the Confederate Army doing duty, not only as laborers, but as real soldiers. Muskets on their shoulders, bullets in their pockets, ready to shoot down loyal troops, and do all that soldiers may to destroy the federal government. Again, yeah, go ahead.
I know that blacks fighting for the Union had very different implications than fighting for the Confederacy.
Yes.
But I feel like it's still almost categorized as heroic in here and in the other.
Yes.
Was there any benefit, or were they fighting as slaves? Or did they gain anything from this?
Your question assumes that you believe William Johnson's account or Frederick Douglass's account. So it's a great question. Yeah, so the reason why a slave would have actually take up arms for the Confederacy, fought for them, even though it's illegal from the Confederacy, primarily is because they're forced to. You know, if your main goal is surviving, to be an enemy within your own army is the easiest way to die. It's the same reason why the easiest way to gain your freedom if you're a slave in the South is to be a whistleblower for a plot of an insurrection. You know, if your goal is surviving and ascending economically, many blacks are willing to be what we now call race traitors or sellouts. You know, for the same reason, to survive. So if you're being put to labor to build a road or fortification, and the master who's overseeing you building this road is now putting a gun at your head and saying, go fight in the front lines because I'd rather have you die than me in the front lines. That's essentially what happens. And in fact, Harper's Weekly has a great image. Here's two blacks who are forced. I mean, there's this guy, you know, the Confederate has a gun at their head, saying, you fire the cannon. Yeah.
Also, wasn't joining the army seen as a good way to escape for slaves, as they were under less close supervision in the army and they were kind of closer to northern territories?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you're getting a little bit ahead of me, but it depended on who your master was. But I should first say the Confederacy faced a dilemma, and that is that the Confederacy did not want to interfere with the master-slave relationship. So the very attempt for the Confederacy to acquire slaves as laborers was met with derision on many accounts. And then after the first Confiscation Act passed in August of 1861, which is an act that allows the Union Army to confiscate slaves who have reached their lines, after that point, slaves who are forced to be laborers for the Confederacy are now, by definition, near Union lines. And the desertion rate is 50 to 70% in some areas. In fact, the Confederacy eventually quits using slaves as laborers because the desertion rate is so high. Which leads to the broader point of all of the eyewitness accounts of blacks serving as Confederates. The vast 95% of them occur between Fort Sumter and the First Confiscation Act. Basically, the first 4 months of the war. That's it. And the total numbers that we have, I've figured, calculated, it's only a couple thousand. Statistically, it's insignificant. It's only symbolically significant because it symbolizes the desire of neo-Confederates to purge the Confederacy of the taint of slavery, and it symbolizes the inability of white liberals to believe that that African Americans can think and act individually rather than as a group. You know, for the same reason that, you know, according to most African Americans, the Republican Party today opposes their interests. Yet 5 to 7% of African Americans are loyal Republicans today. In the antebellum period, there were roughly 1,200 black masters, blacks who owned slaves. All of them were light-skinned blacks whose father had been their master. And until the 1830s, southern states allowed masters in their will to bequeath to their sons not only freedom, but in land and money. So if you're a slave and your dad dies and suddenly you get your freedom and you get 100 or 500 acres and some money, and you have a dream of rising up, you do what you know. And almost all of the 1,200 black masters were in the communities that most closely resembled the Caribbean, which I've mentioned, in which free blacks often align with the masters to gain greater rights in the hopes of equality in Louisiana, Natchez, and Charleston. In the different context, why did some Jews fight for the Nazis? Their two books describe them. Statistically insignificant. Because they want to survive. Why did some slaves reveal an insurrectionary plot? Because they wanted to survive, they wanted their freedom. That's why. Here's the Harper's Weekly on the engraving. It illustrates the way in which the cowardly rebels forced their Negro slaves to do dangerous work. It represents a struggle between two Negroes and a rebel captain who insisted upon their loading a cannon within range. That's the main reason. You know, the slave laborers are said, the master's saying, I don't want to be on the front line. You're my slave, you go be in the front line. It's not legal. The soldier at the time had a legal definition, but most Americans repudiated it. If we understand the Civil War solely in legal terms, that means Southern Unionists, and there were Southern Unionists in virtually every state, they're not legal. Hundreds, if not thousands, of women dressed up as men to fight for both sides, they're not legal because it's illegal for women to fight. Northern blacks, still legal for them to fight until 1863. John Brown's body has cast soldier in a much broader context. John Brown, the second stanza, he's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. That's John Brown. It's why he's heroic. It's not legal. Here's a couple other quotes to supplement the essay that you read. Here's from the official records. Now, these are actually late. These are highly unusual. It's after the First Confiscation Act. It's in one major, Zane, the Captain Hennessy the Connecticut, of 9th Connecticut, captured a colored rebel scout well-mounted who had been sent out to watch our movements. And in another, P.L. Power says, "We have turned up 11 bushwhackers to dry and one rebel Negro." So here's a brief summary of why blacks would fight as soldiers. First, as I mentioned, no more than a few thousand, statistically insignificant. They were not legal, wasn't a legal status until the last month of the war. The slaves who were put to work as laborers, in most cases of the eyewitness accounts of soldiers, the masters who were making them labor saying, "Well, you know, I don't want to be on the front line because I'd rather not die. Chances of dying are greater and you're on the front line. I'm going to put a gun to your head and put you on the front line." And the reason for free blacks in the South showing loyalty to retain is because they wanted to retain what rights they had. Remember, on the eve of secession, every free state, Chief Justice Taney makes it clear in the Dred Scott, free blacks have no rights. There was debates in every southern states about enslaving all free blacks and the desire to retain what rights they had. They show publicly a support for the secessionists, the Confederacy. They don't want to be turned into slaves. So one great example is the Louisiana Native Guards. They never fought, but right after the Louisiana becomes a Confederacy, they march down the streets of New Orleans in full Confederate garb with muskets on their shoulder, showing their public support for the Confederacy. Ben Butler takes Louisiana. It's now in Union hands. And he interviews some of these Native Guards. Said, "Why would you support a nation that totally contradicts who you are, a nation that's conceived in slavery and dedicated to propagate it?" And their response is, "Hey, we hated the Confederacy, but we'd hoped to advance a little nearer to equality with the whites." That's why. That's why. And as I mentioned, almost all the eyewitness accounts point to very early in the war, first until the First Confiscation Act. Let me just briefly summarize as Douglass' evils of a Union war, which is in one of your speeches. It encourages compromise, and if there's compromise, any compromise will allow Confederacy to persist. Deprives us of using 4 million slaves. By making it solely a Union war, it gives the rebels the advantage of fighting for the right to govern themselves. In essence, it goes to number five. It gives the rebels a higher moral ground. Hey, we want the right to govern ourselves, much as the 13 colonies who left Britain, they were fighting for the right to be independent. We are too. By making the Union War, they're only fighting with one hand. They're not using this potent source of black power. And it encourages England and France to recognize the Confederacy. Make this an abolition war and you at once unite the world against the rebels and in favor of the Union government. And that, let me jump now to the road to an abolition war. As I've suggested and from your comments, it begins right away. It begins with blacks joining as independent soldiers for the Union. It begins with Douglass, his decision not to go to Haiti, his understanding that this military war is a golden opportunity to end slavery. And then here are the specific keynotes of it. The first is Ben Butler's contraband policy, which you know from Lou Mazur's Civil War, but let me just summarize it. On May 24, 1861, Ben Butler, the Massachusetts politician, he was not an abolitionist. He was not anti-slavery. Before this point, early on in the war, Ben Butler had vowed to stifle any attempt of blacks in the South to start an insurrection. He was no friend of blacks, and yet he's now stationed at Fortress Monroe, and he needs manpower. He needs workers, and so he admits into Union lines three slaves who had escaped from the rebel army and their as laborers. And the owner goes to Ben Butler, owner sends an agent to Ben Butler, to recover the slaves under the Fugitive Slave Law. And Butler's brilliant response, hey, Virginia's a foreign country. Fugitive Slave Law has no legal implication to a foreign country. And not so, it's a foreign insurrectionary country. I'm not giving them back. You are no longer in the United States. I'm under no obligation. That leads the Congress, U.S. Congress, to pass the First Confiscation Act, which we now know is really that begins and immediately begins to accelerate the engines of emancipation. Until last year, the significance of the First Confiscation Act was downplayed by historians. There's a truly, I think, dazzling book by Adam Goodhart called 1861, and the high point, the climax, is the importance of that First Confiscation Act. What does it say? As I've mentioned, it enables Union officers to confiscate slaves who have reached Union lines. Now, their legal status is vague and in limbo. Doesn't legally or technically free them, but it means they're no longer slaves. And that Confiscation Act immediately is sent through the grapevine telegraph, and almost from that day, I mean, African Americans are making a beeline for Union lines because they know they're going to be protected. The transformation is truly extraordinary in the wake of this First Confiscation Act. And then in August of 1861, still very early, only 4 months into the war, John C. Fremont passes the nation's first Emancipation Proclamation in Missouri, freeing all slaves. I mean, Missouri is just rife with guerrilla warfare. I mean, Missouri is suffering guerrilla warfare from the mid-1850s through at least the end of the war. And John C. Fremont, in an attempt to control it, just emancipates slaves. In the wake, after Northerners hear of his Emancipation Proclamation, there are torchlight parades and celebrations in most of the major cities of the North. Until 12 days later, Lincoln rescinds it. Why does Lincoln rescind it? Because he's worried about the border states. He's worried that Kentucky in particular will secede, Maryland might secede, and we know if the border states start seceding, the war's over. Another important catalyst in the road is the first 6 months or so, the Union is desperate for a victory. The first major Union victories are Fort Donelson and Shiloh. Now, Shiloh is an immensely bloody battle. It's the, I think, fifth bloodiest battle in the Civil War. And to give you some sense of the extent of the bloodshed, Shiloh at that time was the bloodiest battle in the Western world. Bloodier than every one of Napoleon's battles, bloodier than the battle at Crimea. And Americans, both North and South, were shocked. But Grant emerges as this general who's actually willing to fight and to hold and to stay the course, so to speak. And these victories inspire, both inspire Union generals to send notes to the president and the Congress saying, our job is going to be much easier by emancipation. We can use blacks, which is the next point. Generals across the board acknowledge that emancipation as a military policy makes great sense. And generals like U.S. Grant, he was no abolitionist. He was not even an anti-slavery person before the war. But he understood as a general that emancipation was crucial. The blacks are not only a crucial source of manpower, but they know the landscape of the South better than just about anyone. And the Second Confiscation Act in July of 1862 is a kind of prelude to Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. It frees all slaves within Union lines. So it turns the confiscated slaves into freed slaves, makes them forever free, and it also urges the president to pass an Emancipation Proclamation to give this act teeth. So technically the difference between the Second Confiscation Act and Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation is the Second Confiscation Act frees all slaves that are already in the Union lines. The Emancipation Proclamation frees all slaves of rebel masters. Now, if you're a slave and you're working on your plantation, that doesn't carry a lot of weight. But it does further incite blacks to flee to Union lines. By to the point about the class division of the Confederacy, in early 1862, the Confederacy passes the Second Confiscation Act. I'm sorry, the Second Conscription Act, which specifically says that if you own 20 slaves or more, you're exempt from the draft. And among the non-slave owning whites, they start spreading this axiom or mantra that it's a rich man's war and a poor man's fight. Because if you're wealthy, meaning if you own 20 slaves or more, you don't have to fight. Into 1863, as I said, Lincoln continues to champion colonization. He finally abandons it after this plan to send some blacks to an island off of the coast of Haiti. The English translation was it's called Cow Island, and in mid-1863, it was a disaster. Most of them died. The ones that came back were sick, and he eventually abandons it. And so as the war and the devastating effect of the war turns Lincoln into someone who understands that to preserve the Union, to win the war, it has to be a social revolution. Here's in 1862 where he invites blacks to the White House and publicly urges them to emigrate. At the time, there were a few blacks who themselves still championed emigration, but it was a vocal minority. In fact, William Johnson, the black man who you read, whose article you read, who wrote for the Pine and Palm, that was an black emigrationist magazine. But here's Lincoln. You and we are different races. Broader differences than exist between almost any other two races. Your very presence in the country is the cause of the war. Which is a weird inversion. Even though men on both sides do not care for you one way or another, it's better that we both be separated. Now, Douglas's response to this is Douglas responds to this and says that Lincoln is a representative American racist. Now, some scholars have argued that Lincoln gives this public address to blacks at the White House because he wants to pave the way for his Emancipation Proclamation. He's written it. He is waiting for a victory in order to make it public. Lincoln is truly brilliant in gauging public opinion. He never wants to be more than a step ahead of it. He is also uncertain about when and even if in mid-62 he should follow the lead of the Congress and issue an Emancipation Proclamation. And you read a few pieces about Lincoln's religious views. Here's his response to Horace Greeley's The Prayer of 20 Millions. Greeley, the editor of the New York Tribune, is saying that 20 millions of Northerners, which is essentially the Northern population, are praying for an end to slavery. Please issue Emancipation Proclamation. And Lincoln responds, my paramount object is to save the Union. It's neither to save nor destroy slavery. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. Now, again, many scholars have said he's doing this because he wants to pave the way for his Emancipation Proclamation. This was truly Lincoln's chief aim. His chief aim was always to preserve the Union. And here, in terms of whether or not he should issue Emancipation Proclamation, which would make this social revolution much more explicit, unlike Frederick Douglass, unlike the abolitionists, unlike most Northerners and Southerners, Lincoln does not believe he knows God's will. In fact, you could say that Lincoln is a Calvinist. For Lincoln, God is inscrutable, and to presume to know God's will is hubris. Here, the will of God prevails. In great contest, each party claims to act in accordance with the will of God, but both may be and one must be wrong. He's uncertain. You read the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. How he made that public is ultimately Lincoln understood that the closest that you can come of understanding God's will is to look for signs. That's a classic Calvinist understanding. It's hubris to presume to know God's will, but we can look for signs of what God wants. And he knew that there was going to be a major battle between Lee and McClellan, which becomes the Battle of Antietam, because Lee has advanced north. And with the news of Lee's invasion and this upcoming showdown, which would be Antietam, Lincoln actually tells his cabinet that he has entered into a covenant with God. And in this covenant with God, he basically says, if Union achieves a victory, I will take that as a sign that God wants me to make public this Emancipation Proclamation. This is from Gideon Wells, the Secretary of the Navy. And McClellan declared a tenuous victory, truly tenuous victory at Antietam, and the next day Lincoln makes public his Emancipation Proclamation to go into effect January 1st. We'll talk about the difference between the preliminary and the final next week, but I'll briefly say that it's one of the main differences is that it's only the final Emancipation Proclamation that calls for army northern blacks as soldiers. There were some southern blacks who had formed regiments in the fall of 62. Frederick Douglass on the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln did not free the slaves. And this is crucial, I think, to understand, because most Americans still believe that Lincoln freed the slaves. Now, Douglass loved the Emancipation Proclamation. Frederick Douglass said the Emancipation Proclamation should be accorded the same sort of reverence that the Declaration of Independence has. It's one of the twin, it's the two are the twin birthdays of liberty. But Lincoln does not free the slaves. It's absurd to think that one man can free 4 million. And furthermore, events greater than the president, than any one person, had wrung this proclamation from him. Slaves, as much as any other single factor, freed themselves because they fled their masters for Union lines. And now it's much more feasible to do so. Before the Civil War, before Fort Sumter, if most slaves had to go through thousands of miles of slave territory to reach freedom, to reach protection. Now you go 10 miles, 30 miles. Republicans in Congress had been working to dethrone slavery. First Confiscation Act, Second Confiscation Act were crucial. Union soldiers were killing traitors, in other words, military victors, and the fact they're protecting blacks. Abolitionists, the war with Fort Sumner, the abolitionists reunite in one major voice. The Garrisonians, if you remember, had been essentially pacifist, disunionist, believed that violence was wrong. Right after Fort Sumner, William Lloyd Garrison and his followers totally endorse the Union efforts. Again, the abolitionists are speaking as a united front. And Douglass and most other opponents of slavery also saw emancipation as part of this great providential wave of progress. Sorry for going over. We'll see you next week.